This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Jonathan Bennett and I talk with Jeff Geerlin. He's an alpha hacker, big in the Drupal world, has a lot of stuff on GitHub, but you see him all over YouTube. I invite you to look at his stuff. He has a lot of listeners, a lot of viewers, and he goes deeply into Raspberry Pi. We talk about how to make money with YouTube, lots of other related topics, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 705, recorded Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. A slice of Raspberry Pi. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat devoted to simplifying tech topics and providing insight for a new generation of IT professionals. Listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player. Hello again, everybody, everywhere. I am Doc Searles, and this is Floss Weekly. This week, joined by Jonathan Bennett.
Hey, Doc.
In Oklahoma.
Somewhere on the interwebs.
where he can't find the right card for his... Or the thing that failed you, your video card?
I have a nice Magewell capture card to be able to do HDMI input, and that has jumped off to hyperspace. I have no idea where it's at. I have a backup, and every time I plug that in, Zoom would hard lock. And so I'm on the tier 3 solution, the old 1080p Logitech webcam, which works, just not nearly as nice as the big DSLR over across the room.
well, you're looking good. You're the one who got me to actually wear a jacket, you know, it's getting, the weird thing here is that it's fall now, it's getting toward winter, but that means the furnace comes on, so it's hotter down here. In the summer, it's too cold here because the AC, the cold sinks and all that, but anyway.
Yes. Yeah. So if I start, when I very first got started, there's a guy I worked with that wore jean shorts just everywhere all the time, and that kind of annoyed me. And so when I started doing stuff on my own, I'm like, no, I'm going to dress up a little bit.
Yeah, it looks good. It looks good. So our guest today is Jeff Geerlin. Have you studied his work yet?
I rubbed shoulders with Jeff because of the Turing Pi, I think was actually the project. But I've been aware of him because of some other things. Like he's the guy that got the idea that the Raspberry Pi now has a PCI Express slot, not a slot, but a lane on it. Well, that means we could use a desktop GPU, right? And turns out it's not that simple. And he got nerd sniped. He's invested, I think, a couple of years into trying to make that work with some success. I'm sure he'll be glad to tell us more about that.
He does some
cool Linux-y Raspberry Pi stuff, and we mention him on Hackaday from time to time.
Well, we'll have to see if we can get into that. I'm sure we can. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce him. Jeff Geerlin is our guest. He goes by Geerlin Guy, and most places online says his brief bio. A longtime open source guy. He's got his own YouTube channel, which has a lot of stuff on it, and I recommend it. He also maintains many open source projects on GitHub. He's written 4 books that are also out there, which has me beat by 3. anyway, so welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks. Yeah, and 4 books, but 1 complete, 3 incomplete. So not too much beaten, I guess.
Well, I have one that the one I'm best known for is one that I was one of 4 people who wrote. So it's I got like 1 1/4, you know, but maybe because that one sold well and the other one didn't. It's a little different. So you play guitar? I see a guitar in your background there.
Not well. That guitar is actually missing a string, and that string broke in 2020, and that's how long it's been since I've played that guitar. So,
if a pandemic happened and you did not play the guitar during that time, I would say you're not fully committed. So I see the eclipse back there. Were you actually witness to the last eclipse?
Yeah, so it was cool. For anyone that doesn't know, there's another one coming up that's going to go right through the middle of the U.S. in 2024. So start getting your plans together for it. But this eclipse went right in my backyard. We were almost in the center of totality. So I rented camera lenses. I set up everything. We had cameras on our family to see, you know, the whole experience. It was impressive. Like, it was something that I had never expected it to be as cool as it was. And I got that picture out of it. That was a set of images that I compiled. And it was
really
cool.
That's great. What did you shoot that with?
I had a Nikon D750 set up with a 500 millimeter lens, and I just had it focused on the sun throughout the day. And I had a timer because I wanted to manually take the pictures to make sure each one was good. So I had a timer, and I'd go out there every 5 minutes and take a picture. And so I took all the pictures and put them on that series. And I have 300 pictures of the actual eclipse, but you know, you pick the favorite ones.
I do photography, but I decided I'd rather experience the thing. And we drove from Santa Barbara to the very center of Wyoming with my son, who was then, he's 26 now, so he's like 21 then. And we could see the shadow of the moon move across the landscape, which is really cool. And I took a few shots, you know, but with a, you know, 105 millimeter Canon, you know, but the main thing was just witnessing that and waiting to hear all, you know, the birds start chirping and stuff like that, except there were no birds. There were no animals other than the humans. And there were very few of those. So we didn't get to see that. So tell us a little bit about the projects you're working on or you have worked on. So if we go to your GitHub, what are we to see first?
So I've, like, my whole life, I've been focused on open source everything. I got my start in web development and web design, graphic design. And I started out using a system called Drupal, which some people might be familiar with. Drupal is one of the big web content management systems. And when I started on it, the community around Drupal was so helpful in getting me the answers I needed or helping me with some little code problem or helping me with a design issue. So when I started doing that, I just loved the community aspect. And that got me into all kinds of open source. And I started kind of saying, like, if there's an open source way to do it, I'm going to do the open source way. And, you know, on GitHub, I think most of the popular projects are things around automation infrastructure with things like Red Hat's Ansible and Kubernetes, things like that. They're very popular because I was able to get into some of those ecosystems early on. And so some of my work is some of the things that are used a lot in those ecosystems. So, you know, some of the most popular repositories and things are surrounding my Ansible work. And I basically publish all the code that I ever write on GitHub by default. And that's just because I feel like it can help other people. And it also helps me be accountable for security and things like that. Because if you're always publishing in public, you have the tendency to make things more generic and make things like any kind of secrets and passwords and things are always stored in a safer way. So that's just part of my whole philosophy on how I develop things too.
It also makes it a whole lot harder to accidentally forget and leave code on an old hard drive that you then recycle or wipe or something. And then, you know, a couple months later, oh no, where was that project at? Oh, it's on GitHub.
Yeah. Well, not only is all my code on GitHub and it's mirrored on my local computer, I also have a Raspberry Pi with a backup script that uses a tool called GitHub, which is open source. And it synchronizes all my GitHub code down to my local NAS, which is replicated on a second NAS and in Amazon Glacier. So I have at least 5 copies of every project up to date, at least every night. Hopefully I'll never lose any of that.
I like it. So I'm curious, what was the journey going from, well, you started out in web development and then got excited about open source. Where did YouTube come along? Because that's kind of at least where you're known for these days, right?
Yeah, it's funny that before web development, even I did my first ever job was at a radio station, so media, and in radio it's audio, obviously, but they started doing a little bit of video and pictures and things when they got on the web. They wanted to experiment, so I was kind of the guy who got to experiment with some of that stuff. And then when I got into college, I was able to get access to some camera gear and things, and be able to do some cool fun video projects for college for some classes. And I never took an official course on any of it. I just learned by doing. And my dad was also a huge inspiration for it because he bought like the first mini DV camera and let me go to town with it. And I have probably a box full of little mini DV tapes with all the embarrassing things that are not digitized yet. And I bought like a G3 when that came out, and it had a FireWire port, so I could plug the camera in and start editing. So really, since like 2000, probably 1999 or so, I've been doing digital video. And then in 2006, I started a YouTube channel and just put random things on it. If you go way back into the archives, there's I think the first video that is public is like Theseus and the Minotaur, some college project I did for fun. And but then when the pandemic hit, I decided, since I was working from home already and I had a book called Ansible for DevOps, I would kind of make this course for Ansible and make it free and public on YouTube. And people started following it and they really seemed to enjoy it. And it had a lot of traction. So I decided around that time to start getting serious about YouTube. So I started learning how the YouTube algorithm works, kind of hacking into that, figuring out how to make videos get a little more popular with better titles and thumbnails and the pacing of the content. So for the past couple of years, I've been focusing a lot more on that. But what's cool is that has allowed me to finally, I don't have a full-time job for a big company anymore. Now I have, I do YouTube and my books basically and the blog. That's basically my full income. And it's really cool because I get to work on open source projects and publish open source code. And that's kind of my full-time gig. Now, obviously, editing video, that takes time out of the open source work, but
yes.
But it's been really awesome to be able to do that.
Okay, I'm going to go down the video nerd hole here just for a second. What video editor did you get started with, and what are you using now?
So the first video editor I ever used, I believe was, I think it was Avid. It wasn't like the big production system Avid. They had a consumer version of it that they'd ship with the video capture card on an old Mac. And so I learned yeah. that, and it was like, back then it was like, it's an NLE, a nonlinear editor. Cause that was a new thing. Mm-hmm. You know, film was linear editing. It was not right. very fun. So digital editing was something amazing. And that's, you know, me getting my start there is kind of like if somebody got their start in digital photography and never did film, like you get a lot more, you go from 0 to 100 a lot faster if you start in the digital realm. And that's where I started. But then again, my dad, he bought Final Cut Express, like the first version of that that came out. And that's, so I learned a lot more on that because that's when I got that Parmac G3. And I started doing a lot more video, just fun production and stuff. So I still use Final Cut Pro, but I've used Premiere and I've used Resolve. So, you know, all the different applications. And I use Final Cut Pro because of the momentum. I've used it for years and I know most of the keyboard shortcuts at this point.
Yes. Oh, yes. No, it is quite the endeavor to try to switch editors. Oh, goodness. Have you ever dipped your toes in on the other side and tried something like Kden Live or Ardour for your video workflow?
I did actually try Kden Live. Yeah, I spent a couple weeks seeing if I could get into using Kden Live on a really fast PC laptop. It was the forget what version of the laptop it was, but it was one of those laptops like built to be like the best Linux laptop on the market. And Kden Live worked pretty well. The only thing is, like, there's a lot of little things that you do, especially on YouTube with titling and with transitions and things, that they were a little bit harder to do in Kden. And the other problem is there's a lot of plugins that you just can't get for open source editors. And a lot of those plugins are things that make life easier for audio editing or for cleaning up video or stabilization, things like that. So, you know, for the raw editing, I didn't have a problem. It was just all the little things, the little cherries on top that make a YouTube video pop, which is necessary if you want to get the views and have the traction. So unfortunately, I think right now the open source editors aren't to that state where you could really put them into a typical professional workflow unless you really pigeonhole it into the editing portion. Or if you're doing something simpler.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. It's kind of the experience I've had as well. I got started actually using Sony Vegas way back in the day. I think Sony Vegas 4 or so. We're dating ourselves just a little bit here. I put the time in to learn Kden Live, and still when I sit down to do certain things with Kden Live, it's like, oh, this is so clunky. It's great, but it's some yeah. things about it are just clunky. It's like somebody that really knows what they're doing with the user experience side and the video editing side needs to sit down for about a year with the dev team and say, okay, we're going to work this out. And then it would be great. It's about a year's worth of work away from being just great.
Yeah. I think that's for visual arts and for creative work. That seems to be the theme for all the open source tools. Like a lot of them have the great engine underneath. They just need some polish, but the hard thing is the polish is the one thing that, you know, a proprietary software setup often has the ability to pour tons of money and resources into the user research, into the, you know, the graphic design portion that open source communities just can't get.
Do you think that is because of the funding? Is it usually a money problem? Because what comes to mind is Ardour. I don't know if you've messed with Ardour much, but it's mainly an audio editor. And it is slick. Ardour is great, especially with their new release. They've got some really cool stuff in there. And people actually use it for professional music production. And one of the things Ardour's done is when you go to their website and you go to download a binary, how does it work? Every 5 minutes, it inserts silence into your tracks, I think. And you have to pay to get a binary that works 100%. You have to pay some money. No, not a whole lot, but a little bit. And I'm wondering if maybe that funding model has done a lot to kind of help the polish, to fund the polish, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, especially for the graphic design portion, you don't get quality work for free in that world. Unfortunately, like it's just, you can't, somebody needs to devote enough time. And, you know, with a lot of code things and software, you have corporate sponsors that'll sponsor patches and things, and you have individuals who can kind of dip in and dip out. But I find that the creative process, like building new user interface and putting up the resources to get, you know, in that editor, the really nice graphs and graphics and the motion and things, all those little pieces of icing that make the product really shine, that seems to always take that extra polish that does need funding. So that's one area that even in my work in Drupal, that was always a pain point, was theming and design. A lot of the other systems that had the companies that would sell themes and things instead of giving away free open source stuff, they would have the better theming, they would have the better theme engines and things because the designers would be in that court. They wouldn't be in the completely free and open source court.
Yeah, we talk with a lot of projects about this, and it seems to be one of the not entirely solved problems in open source, right? So like some projects, just by their nature, it works really well for businesses to cooperate on them. I think Ansible is probably one of those projects because nobody sells Ansible. You use Ansible to make services that you sell. You use Ansible to make things. Whereas Kdenlive, it's hard to sell a service on top of Kdenlive. You know, so the regular open source model maybe doesn't map quite 100% to it. And, you know, we've had Ardour, Paul Davis on the show and talked to him about that and kind of the place that they've come to. So it's interesting. And, hopefully one of these days we'll all figure it out together.
Yep. Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about your journey down the rabbit hole of the Raspberry Pi?
Yeah. So, like I said, my dad has really introduced me to a lot of these things. He introduced me to electronics, and I remember distinctly one of the first computing experiences was he brought home kind of the husk of a 386 that was dead and said, "Here's this, and I'll bring home some other parts. If you can get a working computer, it's yours." And that was my first, you know, DOS 6 computer that I used. And I upgraded that thing over the years. I eventually got it to a 486, and I got like Windows 3.1 on it, and I got Doom running on it, all these fun things. But he always would bring me these parts, and I would put them together. So I was always deep into the hardware aspect, which is ironic because I'm a Mac user primarily. That's what I do my editing on. That's
What went wrong?
Yeah, exactly. People are like, "What? How can you..." But I mean, I've always loved the hardware aspect. But on the flip side, you know, when I want to get an edit done, I use my graphical interface. I use a Mac and Final Cut Pro and a lot of proprietary software. But I've always wanted to continue down the hardware path. For the past, you know, 10 or 12 years before the Raspberry Pi came along, there wasn't a whole lot of, I guess, what you would call hobby computing. There always has been. It's a very dedicated community of people out there. But it wasn't like a mainstream thing, and it was hard. It was hard to get into it, and it required hardware that sometimes wasn't well supported and things like that. So when the Raspberry Pi came out, I bought one like right away because I was like, this is cool. It's cheap. And it went in a box. And that's how most people, and you know, you buy one and you're like, I can do all these cool things, but it ends up in a box or in your drawer. So a couple of years later, I started just playing around with it. That's like my dad would give me things and I would play around and either they would break or they would work. And then sometimes if it works, you sell it and you get some money. And then you realize like, oh, this is cool. I can do things, earn money, get more stuff and break more things. So eventually I was like, I want to get Drupal to run on here because I hadn't seen anybody else have Drupal, the open source system running on a Raspberry Pi. This was 2013, 2014, probably 2013, I think it was. And so I got my website to run on it. It was very slow and very horrible, but it taught me a lot of things about how a system like Drupal would respond to running in a really slow environment or with really slow networking. And so I started digging in deeper. I built a cluster of Raspberry Pis called a bramble because, you know, if you have raspberries in a bush, it's a bramble. And so I made what I called the Dramble, the Drupal Raspberry Pi bramble. And I learned even more. I actually found a major bug in Drupal with the way that it would set up its one of its kind of semaphores for how it interacts with multiple file systems across multiple pies in the web server portion. So I found that bug, and at DrupalCon, the founder of Drupal came over to the table where I was working on it, and he's like, "Oh, that's cool." And I'm like, "Yeah, I found this bug." And he's like, "Oh, that's even more cool." And it's just like little things like that are fun to me. And that bug probably didn't cause super high amount of grief for a lot of people in the world. It's mostly a bug that would come up if you had networking issues. So if you're in Amazon and your Drupal system is going slow for some reason, you might run into that bug. On the Raspberry Pi, I ran into it every time. So that was a cool thing. But I don't know. For me, it's always those fun little experiments. Somebody said, like earlier today, I saw someone posted that Jeff Geerling is like an 80s computer magazine, but for Raspberry Pis. And I like that. It's like there's so much potential. There's so many crazy things that we can do, and we can always learn things. Some people I think don't get like just exploration. But that's where I learned so much about how Linux works. You get really deep into the internals of Linux, how drivers work, how hardware interfaces. And the nice thing about the Raspberry Pi with that for me is it's on a lower level and always a few generations behind. So the documentation for things is actually better. And people have blog posts about the random things you run into that if you're on cutting edge hardware all the time, you might not find those things. But I don't know. I just love the kind of the hacker mentality, and Raspberry Pi has really hit the stride for that for me. And the big thing for me is the fact that it's supported by the Raspberry Pi Foundation or by Raspberry Pi themselves. The sad thing for me is right now in 2022, it's so hard to find a Raspberry Pi. I want to share with people, yes, and I want them to be able to do everything I do. And right now it's so hard for them to be able to do it because you can't buy them. They're not available anywhere in stock.
Yeah, it's getting a tiny bit better. You know, I think one of the things about the Raspberry Pi is it came along at the right time, and it got momentum. It hit critical mass where some of the other boards, you know, there was the BeagleBone. There was the Arduino, which there's still the Arduino. Oh, goodness, that thing. Okay, the Arduino hit critical mass too, but it's in a different space than the Raspberry Pi. The Raspberry Pi, the first one, had just barely enough processing power to run Linux and maybe do something useful. But you know, like you said, you had the Raspberry Pi Foundation, and just all these different things came together at the right time that you hit critical mass with it. And now it's everywhere. So you almost have better success depending upon what problem. So trying to Google a problem, you know, your general approach to Googling is going to be, okay, here's kind of what the problem is, and then Linux. And well, you'll get some good stuff. You almost have better success these days. Okay, here's what the problem is, Raspberry Pi. Because there's so many people out there using it. And there's so many young people out there using it. And maybe making dumb mistakes, which results in good answers being put on the internet. I don't know. The Raspberry Pi is something special. It's just cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also like the Raspberry Pi Pico, this is the Pico W, the new one that's, I think, $6. It's also kind of reignited a little bit of that hardware hacker mentality that I had from my youth. My dad brought home an FM radio kit one time from Radio Shack, and I remember soldering it together thinking it's like, oh, you mean like you can actually make this thing that receives radio? You don't have to buy it from the store. Same thing with the Pico. You realize quickly with that and like ESP Home and ESP32 devices that you can wire up to sensors and to a thermometer or to a soil sensor for gardening, all these different things that you can do. You realize like it's not magic. It's people make these devices that we buy that are Internet of Things devices. And if you do it yourself and understand how it works, it's actually pretty simple and you can do it better than off the shelf solutions a lot of times. So that's been really cool for me too. And luckily the Pico, the Raspberry Pi Pico is actually available. So some of the projects that I'm working on right now with that, I can actually say like, oh, and you can go buy one instead of, and watch me do it.
So have you gone down the route of something like learning Rust to program the Pico? That seems like that'd be a real interesting learning experience to do Rust on the bare metal for the Pico.
Not yet. I'm still working mostly in higher level languages. Like I use MicroPython on the Pico. And I mentioned ESP Home, which is basically a way to use a tool to build a kind of a thing that runs on the Pico instead of you doing it yourself. I'm working on a video for that right now, but the reason I do that is most of the time I'm trying to build things that are more beginner friendly because it plays better on YouTube. So it's easier. It's a wider audience. And also with an eye towards the future, I have four kids and I want to, I want to start doing some more projects with them. So I want to start in a way that they could approach right away instead of digging straight into like, we're going to learn C in assembly today. I learned on PHP, which is pretty high level. And, I think there's a valid approach to either way, going straight into a deeper level with the hardware versus going high level, which is a lot less optimized and you can run into other problems and have memory issues and things. But for me, I typically tend to stick to the more beginner friendly setups.
Okay. Now you say that, but you've got projects like the Petabyte Pi and trying to strap a desktop GPU to a Raspberry Pi. I'm not sure those are exactly beginner friendly.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I should reevaluate where I go with some of those things. But I even with those, I still try to go back to the roots of, this is a storage array. It's a hard drive and it's 60 hard drives, but it's a hard drive, or how are we getting the hard drive into the Raspberry Pi? And how do we get that bigger and more exciting? So in those videos, sometimes I do go pretty deep. And I can see in the YouTube analytics, it shows you like parts of the video. And I'm like, when I get into a deep dive on the MPT3 SAS driver, it's like the viewership is like drops down. So, but I still like to do some of that. I still like to, I guess part of it is pride. Like I can still do something cool. I'm not just a beginner. But it's fun to see that.
Do keep in mind that there are some really geeky folks. Like, there's a good crew over at Hackaday and we follow some of the stuff you do too. And we really appreciate the deep dive bones. There may not be as many of us as, your whole channel, but there's a decent handful of us that really appreciate it.
Well, you're going to get a bunch of shallow dives from me who go from one video to another to another to another to partially prepare for this show. I've got a number of questions actually about the whole YouTube thing, but first I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat devoted to simplifying tech topics and providing insight for new generation of IT pros. It's hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simino, and it closes the gap between those who are new to technology and those behind the inventions and services that shape the world. Compiler brings together stories and perspectives from the industry and simplifies the language, culture, and movements in a way that's fun, informative, and guilt-free. You want to stay on top of tech without the time spend? An original podcast from Red Hat, Compiler Presents Perspectives, topics and insights from the tech industry, free from jargon and judgment. They want to discover where technology is headed beyond the headlines and create a place for new IT professionals to learn, grow, and thrive. Compiler helps people break through barriers and challenges, turning code into community at all levels of the enterprise. In one episode, they cover the great stack debate. The software stack is like an onion or a sheet cake or lasagna, or is it? That's a big question. It's often described as having layers that sit on top of each other. The reality, however, is much more complicated, and learning about it can help any tech career. The Great Stack Debate is the first episode in Compiler's series on the software stack. They call it Stack Unstack. They explore each layer of the stack, what it's like to work on them, and how they can come together into a whole application. Another episode covers, are we as productive as we think? The pressure to balance productivity with passion projects, personal responsibilities, or just with the need to rest is challenging. Their team spoke with tech-minded creators in the productivity space on how to achieve full focus and how to make time for work, relaxation, and creativity. This is a good one for people like me. I'm an ADD case from the beginning. I can use all the help I can get on all that stuff. So learn more about Compiler at red.ht/twit. Listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to Compiler for their support. So Jeff, you were saying earlier that your day job is actually doing all the stuff you love to do, and especially with the YouTube thing. Most of your videos have hundreds of thousands of views, and one of them I think is over a million, like 1.2 million on one of your Raspberry Pi ones. So I've never tried to do this. I've like YouTube sent me a note saying, "Hey, you could make money doing this," and I have not posted a video since 2009. So it got like 45 views. So I'm wondering, I mean, what's this business like? I mean, is it a business for, I guess that is a business for you. You make it is. Money from advertising, I guess. Is that how it goes?
Yeah. So when I finished college, I actually set up an LLC. It's called Midwestern Mac LLC. There's a website for it you can even check out. And when I did that, I also monetized my YouTube channel way back when. And this was like 2008 or 9. It was around that time when YouTube said, like, you can monetize your videos, you can earn money from them. And at the time, I had a few videos up, and they would get a few hundred views a year, something like that. So I got like $1 a month, maybe. Not much. You can't live on that. So over time, though, there's a whole economy that's kind of grown up around YouTube specifically for people who do either educational content. Some people do pop content. You know, there's big YouTubers like Mr. Beast in the world and PewDiePie and things like that do more popular culture things, gaming and challenges and whatnot. But there's always been another community on YouTube for education, tech, things like that. That's kind of, I see it as kind of an undercurrent. It's never something that you see bubble up to the top of like, oh, these are YouTube people. It's more like, oh, that guy's on YouTube. And so I kind of wanted to go that route with my content. And before I made the dive into doing YouTube and my books full time, I planned out like, what are the numbers I need to hit to be able to make a living off of this? And so one of the strategies I had, which was something already from my open source work, was how can I get funding, kind of a crowdfunding model, but people who watch my content on YouTube, people who use my open source tools. So I set up a Patreon, and at the same time that I set that up, GitHub Sponsors was a new program on GitHub. And I had a target. I said, I have to be able to make enough money to pay the mortgage and my health insurance. And if I have growth and I can get to the point where I can do that, I know that I'll be able to grow enough to be able to replace some of my income. At this point in my life, I'm not making nearly as much money as I did when I did software consulting, but it's enough to live on, and it's enough to pay for health insurance and things like that that are very important for me and my family.
Yeah, I'm looking here. You have sponsoring on GitHub and sponsoring on Patreon. And then, You've got a Bitcoin address.
Yeah, the Bitcoin, PayPal. I think I've gotten about $16 in my life through that Bitcoin address. But it is funny. Some people do find my website and I'll get like a $20 donation on PayPal. And I always send an email and thank people because it, like, to me, that means the world that somebody, it's so rare for somebody to see something that somebody puts out for free in the world, whether it's open source software, or blogs, or whatever. And not only thank them, but also give them something concrete in return. Like, especially for me, a lot of times, if I find a piece of software that saves me a few hours, I'll just go and see if there's a donation button. And if there is, I'll give them $10 or $20 or $50 or whatever it is. Something to show that person, like, hey, you saved time in my life, and that's huge for me. Here's a concrete thanks for that. And so many people, they might get $1 a year, or $10 in a year or something. I earn my living off of it, so I know the value of it. But these people, you know, you get a donation that's something more sizable, and it can make a difference. You can be like, wow, there might be a future in this that could lead to some sort of sustainability for me.
You know, there's a nonprofit I work on. It's small. It has potential to be really big, but still it's small. And to test the donate button on it, I actually sent it $5 yesterday. And I'm thinking, I need to send a note to myself because I did send a note to the one person who gave us money like 5 years ago in that thing. But I'm wondering how the market works there. I mean, in the sense that, you know, if I'm famous for anything, it's for having said markets are conversations, and you're kind of showing that with that. When you have hundreds of thousands of views, do you have a sense of how many viewers that is? Like what your constituency is and what that the dimensions of that conversation are?
Yeah, that may YouTube not be actually gives
a
you
a knowable thing.
Well, YouTube gives you a pretty deep insight into the audience that your channel has. And I've seen it evolve a little bit over the years. This is something that I personally want to change it a little bit, but it's 98% male. And, you know, it's computing topics, electronics, things like that. That's kind of the world that we live in. But it gives you an idea of who you're talking to. And so part of the whole YouTube game is figuring out how you can gain an audience, how you can grow the audience, and how you can kind of keep them engaged. And I think that's one of the reasons I like being kind of in the undercurrent, the tech and education space, is the community around it is not like toxic. It's not annoying, divisive, and things like that. Usually when there's any drama or something, it's because someone made a technical error. And that's what we, you know, if somebody does something wrong with software or makes a statement that's a little bit incorrect about the speed of a CPU, like those are things that we can kind of fight each other on, and it's more of a fun and uplifting thing rather than tearing each other down. So that's been my thing, is trying to find that community, which I think I have found a really nice community in YouTube of people who are interested in electronics, interested in Linux, open source, Raspberry Pis, things like that, and also just the idea of hacking things to do things that they weren't meant to do in a fun and positive way. And at this point, I'm trying to make sure that that's sustainable. So not only feeding back into the books that I write, so the books also provide a source of income, but also making sure that that feeds back into the community that I have through Patreon and through GitHub. And because YouTube may or may not be forever, I don't think it will be. And typically a channel like mine would have a lifespan of 7 to 10 years. We're just starting to get metrics on that in the YouTube world. So, you know, you have to plan for that. I'm planning for retirement because I'm going to retire someday. And I want to make sure that if YouTube goes away completely, I can still do things in life and I can still do these projects and share them in other ways too.
Well, I'm not a good example of retirement because I never will.
Well, I'd like to retire someday. I don't think I will.
I get pitched for it all the time. But yeah, I get pitched for it because of my demographic. But I'm wondering, I mean, you know, we're looking at the back channel here, and the 90X percent male thing is, I mean, the Linux Journal, which I worked at for almost 25 years, we were owned entirely for a while by women. All of our executive team was women, and our readership was between 99 and 100% male. And yeah. And I'm just wondering, I mean, do you have any ideas about how to get more, I mean, diversity in there? I mean, an advantage, by the way, I should say about the whole tech thing is that you're dealing with the concrete. I mean, mm-hmm. there are facts here, right? You know, there's not a whole lot of misinformation because it just doesn't work, right? But I'm wondering if you have any ideas about that. I don't. I've we tried a lot and didn't get anywhere with it. So
yeah. No, I've actually experimented a little bit with some of my videos, changing up the style or the thumbnail and title and things like that to see what things might attract a little bit more diversity in the audience. And sometimes I've gotten videos up to like 8 to 9% female audience, which is, it's interesting to me. And usually what the difference was is if you focus on less technical aspects and more personal aspects, at least for my channel, that's been the keys. And, But it's a strange thing. I don't understand it because most of the teams I've worked on in the past, software teams, most of the teams have been like, 2 to 4. The ratio has been closer to 50-50, a lot closer than everything I see online with readership and viewership on YouTube. And like you said, with Linux Journal and things like that. So it's a hard nut to crack. I don't know. I have seen toxic behavior from parts of different communities, and it kills me every time I see it, but it's definitely not the norm, and I don't know what else has to happen to kind of shift that over time, because I know one of my daughters does seem to like some technical things, and it'd be cool if she had a future in it, but it'd also not be cool if she was discouraged by some things that she encountered.
So you say you have 4 kids. Mm-hmm. What's the breakdown of those, and how much are they involved in what you do?
The oldest one is 9, and he's interested in some of the things I'm doing, and he likes kind of makerspace things and things like that. But we also are pretty careful, especially since I'm so deep in YouTube and social media and things. I worked for a company that did personalized advertising for a short time, and I know the dangers in a lot of those areas. So we are very careful about their online life and technology use and things like that. It's funny. The people that are the most careful are the people that are the most technologically literate, I think. So we've intentionally kind of held them back a little bit from where I think some of my peers would have their kids be if they were doing YouTube stuff and all that. But we kind of let them express what they're interested in. And so far, they don't have as deep of interest in electronics and Raspberry Pis and things like that, but we'll see. I mean, the other part of it is my wife and I have decided we're not going to let our kids have an online presence until, at least that they're, 13 is like the minimum age, but I think it'll be beyond that because we've seen some of the struggles that people have being online and as children, especially if you have, I'm Jeff Geerling on YouTube, but I'm also dad at home. I don't want those worlds to cross over and cause conflict between my kids and I, or cause problems for them at school or anything like that. So we basically leave them out of the online life at this point.
Do they have, I take it then they don't have phones of their own, or if they do, they're very rudimentary ones.
Right now they don't have any phones or anything. We have a family iPad, and that's used in a monitored area of the house. We're pretty strict on it. I think it's a hard battle too, because like I do remember when I was a kid, my dad would bring that computer home. That was when I was 10. So none of my kids are quite 10 yet. But I remember having that freedom also gave me a lot of opportunity. But the internet was not a thing at that point. We got a modem a couple of years later. So giving people full access to the online world, to comments and to forums and things like that, that's a totally different thing these days. And I think so far our society hasn't really figured out the best way to handle that yet. And I think we're all experimenting with it. We're taking a little bit stricter approach than most people probably, but it feels like that's a better approach than to kind of dive head first and give our kids access to things that we don't have as much control over.
Yeah, I've thought about this too. So I've got 2 kids. I've got a 3-year-old boy and a 1-year-old girl, and so they're too young to even really be having the conversation with them yet about the internet or any of that. But I've thought about that because it's coming, and mm-hmm. so I've thought about things like, first off, I've got a responsibility of how much I put them on the internet. Like even from a consent viewpoint, right? Because like they're too young to have an opinion on it. So I want to be kind of conservative about that. That you know, I don't want to take advantage of their cute pictures, right? Like you could do a YouTube channel that's all about your little kids being cute. But then you think, well, what's going to happen in 10 years when they realize what you've done with them and they go and they look back at it? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want my kids to eventually say, you sold me on YouTube.
Yeah, that's a huge struggle. And, you know, there's two sides to it as well. Even if you have like a private social media account, which a lot of my friends do, and they share pictures of their kids, you know, Halloween was big. Everybody shares hundreds of pictures of their kids on Halloween. My wife and I discussed this quite a bit. We basically decided we don't want to have any photos or anything attaching our kids' image to an online presence until the kids decide to do that, and until at least 13. And you know, it's funny looking back on that decision with where we are with like AI and machine learning right now. It might even be a better advantage for them, or it might be a disadvantage. Who knows how the world turns out in terms of like health insurance or car insurance or things like that, where it can look at a history of a person online and say, this person has a risk profile that's too great for us to charge, or they charge more or less. These things are things I'm thinking about all the time. And, you know, the more data that you feed into that system by posting pictures and posting statements and things, the more data that these companies will have to kind of aggregate a profile on every person on the earth, even if that person never signed up for a service. And I think that's a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, you even hear horror stories these days about people go to try to get a job, and one of the first things that the place looking to hire them does is pull up their social media accounts and, you know, yeah, peruse through all the things that are publicly available. And it's a big deal posting things on the internet, and I'm not sure that, like you say, a young kid really fully understands the ramifications of maybe what they do online. And that's not even to discuss the dark side of the internet and all of the nasty things that are potentially out there that if you don't know what to not look for, you can stumble into. And yeah, that's not good either.
It's a different world right now. I mean, we're all digital beings. We're being digital right now. You know, your living is in the digital world. All of us live in this digital world as well as the physical one. And it's miraculous. It's miraculous that really at no cost, we're in video form with each other and audio form, no matter where we are in the world. And I mean, I'm on calls almost every day with people in Australia and Europe and other places, and there's no sense of distance. My wife's joke about that is not even a joke, is that there's no gravity either. We're just kind of floating here. There's no sense of grounding, and kids need that, you know? And I remember when I was a kid, I started kindergarten at 5 years old in a suburban New Jersey. It was really blue collar suburban New Jersey. And my mother took me to school the first day. So this is the way home. Go to school the next day, if, you know, going to kindergarten. I walked to kindergarten a half mile through city blocks, and you know, parents just sent kids out, you know, get out of here, go play outside somewhere and hope they came home, you know. And now everybody's like hyper concerned, things are going to happen to the kids and everything. Mm-hmm. And there's actually even more to be concerned about being the kids getting pickled in gossip online over which the parents have no control, and where facts don't matter at all, you know, and rumor and gossip, which is really important to civilization, is an awfully big part of what we do online. So I don't have an answer for that other than knowing that we're really early in whatever this becomes. That's sort of my sense of it. Do you have that feeling as well?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think that our kids' generation is going to be the first one that actually has some answers, and it's going to take a long time to get there. And sadly, I think we're still going to see tragedy a lot. I also think, like, you know, even though we're very strict about it, when they go to school or when they go to other places, obviously we don't have the guardrails at our house at those places. But it's funny, like the funny thing that I see, and this is one thing that I do like seeing in my son that I see in a lot of kids that have this curiosity, is kids will find ways, no matter what guardrails you put up, they'll find ways around them as much as they can to satisfy their curiosity. You know, they found out that through their school computer, in the school's kind of locked down sense, they can still form an online community around, I think it's Scratch, the code editor. Scratch has basically an online kind of private forum, but you can get around it and find ways to interact with other people that do Scratch. So kids will find these ways. But the key is, are we setting them up for success? Are we showing them, you know, how to interact with people better or not at all sometimes? And that's the struggle that we have. Because especially as, you know, if Mark Zuckerberg gets his way and everybody joins the metaverse, that's a completely different interaction model than going outside and playing with your neighbors. So how do we make it so that both are good experiences and we don't lose either, because there is value, like you said, in this virtual space that we're in. But we have had experiences in our lives that make it valuable. If someone doesn't have the experience of being person to person before, that changes things. And I think it's going to be probably one of the great challenges for the next generation, is figuring all this out and making it work instead of, you know, whatever we're doing right now. I don't think it's working that well, judging by society.
Oh, I have thoughts about that, and I know Doc has some other things he wants to get into, but I want to talk about something else of value, and that's Club Twit. Club Twit is another great way to support the Twit network. You get access on Twit, as well as some other really interesting things, like there's a few shows that are exclusive to the Club Twit Discord, one of those being the Untitled Linux Show, the weekly Linux show that I and a couple of other guys host, and we dive deep into news, some technical stuff, command line tips of the day. It's a lot of fun. And then also coming up on Discord on the 17th, they convinced me to do an Ask Me Anything. It can be live with Ant, I believe. And so get on Club Twit, get your questions in there, and you can torture me with the weirdest questions that you can come up with. So go sign up for Club Twit. It's just $7 a month. It's twit.tv/clubtwit. And join today. And we thank you for your support.
Hey, so we're holding on to Jonathan there. I want to talk the highly professional kind of TV we call TV and what's happened to TV. You've had quite a number of videos on that. While some people are busy cutting the cord on cable, you're talking about cutting the cord on Netflix, which is what people cut the cord on cable for. And how the great promise of Netflix, I mean, I had for the longest time, I just thought if it was a movie, it was ever produced in history, Netflix has it in its library, and that library is mostly gone. And 90% of what they're producing is no better than the crap that we got away from on cable. Nobody knows where sports are anymore. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I want to see this. I'm a New England fan, so where are the Patriots playing? I don't know. Is it on Fox something? Is that something? We have a Roku TV, you know, and you have a cool video about how to make your own smart TV. I think that's kind of cool. So tell us how you kind of have been riding those trends and where you're going with that.
Yeah, I mean, history repeats itself. Netflix became cable and kind of changed their model, and all these different streaming services now are basically cable companies, but even worse, because now you have to subscribe to 12 instead of one. But all the prices are increasing. They're adding advertisements. The content is just, you know, churned out garbage now. And like you said, the biggest thing for me was when I saw Netflix come out, that was around the time I was getting into my career and before I had a family and things. I just saw like Netflix could be the vision of, we can watch any movie. And that's really cool. You don't have to go to Blockbuster anymore. But then as time went on, all the movies went off the service, and it's like, well, what's the point of Netflix? There's, you know, maybe one good show a year that they put out, maybe two or three, depending on your likes. But I kind of got disgusted with it and decided to go back to a model that I was doing before Netflix, which was I would rip DVDs onto my computer so that I could watch them, you know, from another computer or whatever. And so now I'm back to that again. When I buy a Blu-ray, I just got the Top Gun Maverick. I'm going to put it on the computer so that my wife and I can watch it on our TV, because otherwise we'd have to subscribe to some other service that I I don't know, Paramount Plus or something. But like you said, it's hard to even find where things are. When I was a kid, I remembered growing up loving to watch Cardinals baseball and Blues hockey, the two teams here in St. Louis. And the reason was they had free over-the-air TV broadcasts almost every week of one or two games. And so as a kid, I would learn how hockey worked and things and how baseball was played and all that. But now, you know, it's like, well, this week it'll be on Fox Sports, or I think that's not even a thing anymore. This week it'll be on Bally Midwest, and next week it'll be on ESPN and Apple TV. And it's too confusing to keep up with it. The one thing that I saw that was interesting, I don't know how it'll play out, is it looks like with the Major League Soccer, they're planning on having either free or paid access without blackout restrictions for their games. But it's, again, on Apple TV. It's like, it's so hard to get into sports nowadays because you can't even follow it without subscribing to five different services or paying $100 a month for something. I'm not going to do that to watch a couple games a month. So I wish these companies would figure out, like, you would put an end to piracy if you just made it easier for people to see things. I'm willing to pay. I do pay. I have paid for years for different things, but I'm not willing to pay seven different services, six different rates that change every month. And for me, I'm not going to pirate, but a lot of people, the answer is, well, go to piracy because it's easier. And sadly, it's easier to pirate content nowadays because sometimes you can't even watch, even if you're willing to pay $1,000, there's some content that you just can't watch because it gets blackholed. It goes off of streaming services. So anyway, it disgusts me how bad that's gotten, like with how good we had the vision with Netflix originally, with how bad things have gotten as everything fragments again.
So when you talk about that, what comes to mind is Steam, because with computer video gaming, there was a similar problem, and Steam really kind of solved it. And, you know, people would pirate. And you find out that when you finally make a good platform and you put a whole bunch of titles in one place and you make it easy for people to buy what they want, the piracy problem kind of tends to go away. And yeah, that's interesting. And well, I won't rant about computer video gaming because that's not what we're here for. I'm curious, what front end are you using for your smart TV that you made? Are you doing Kodi or Roku?
We have a couple Apple TVs, and the reason I chose those is because, like, of all the different devices, it seems like they're the easiest for a kid to pick up a remote and click around and figure it out. But we use Jellyfin for the media library, and mm-hmm. On the Apple TV, we actually use a app that the kids call Doritos because the shape of the logo looks kind of like a Dorito. So they're like, oh, we're going to go to Doritos and watch Berenstain Bears. So they pop in there, and it's called Infuse. But there is an app for Jellyfin that's coming to the Apple TV. But that we chose Jellyfin because it's an open source fork of, I think it was MB. And Jellyfin, the community around it, again, just like with Drupal, the community around it was the reason I stuck with it instead of something like Plex, which a lot of people choose. It feels a lot more open, supportive, and positive, and just the way that people develop plugins and basically integrate it with everything. It checked off all the boxes that I had, and you can see on that article some of the reasons why I chose it.
Yeah. Now, have you gone down the route yet of trying to digitally capture over-the-air TV? You live in St. Louis, I think, so there would be a decent handful of over-the-air channels to choose from, too, potentially.
Yeah, I do have an HD Home Run, and usually we use that. It's integrated with Jellyfin. Usually that's used when there's a tornado warning. We pop it on our iPad down here and watch in the basement and make sure that we're not going to have a tornado run us over. But
I feel that.
But yeah, yes. I've thought about it. The thing is that, you know, like you mentioned earlier, a lot of the content moved to cable, and then nowadays it's moving to streaming services. It seems like over-the-air TV doesn't get as much of the good, interesting TV shows anymore. So, you know, besides reruns and things, which there's less value for me to watch older shows, there's not as much that I really want to record off live TV to watch later, like a TiVo. But I can do it. I've thought about it for a couple shows.
Yeah, there's, you know, you mentioned sports. There's some sports things that are available there. It really is interesting, though, to kind of to cut all of those things and go to your own solution. It's pretty neat that it's possible now. Although, I think aren't we all technically violating the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, when we rip our DVDs and Blu-rays?
Yes, technically still. So the EFF and a couple other organizations have been working to change that law because it's kind of crazy. Like, you can buy a DVD or a Blu-ray and you can make a copy, but if you break the encryption, if you take the bits and rearrange them in a way that lets them play back on your computer, then all of a sudden you've broken the DMCA. Unless you're a educator showing the TV for criticism in a class, or you're somebody that's remixing content for either journalistic purposes or something like that. So technically, when I made the video about it, I remixed the video into a video to criticize Hollywood. So is it legal?
Oh, goodness.
So we're down into the, boy, this is a topic that's close to my mind and heart. We just got a new house, and I'm thinking, we actually have a gigantic crawl space. It's 10 feet high in the attic, and I could put an antenna up there. I could put a rotator on it, and because all we get locally is the local PBS station, but there's nothing there. I know there's nothing there, you know, and it's because there's nothing there, and there's nothing on cable either. You know, Roku has like lots and lots of ancient TV shows that I liked when I was a kid, like in the 60s. And you look at like Gunsmoke or Bonanza, they're really bad. I didn't know they were bad at the time, but they really are bad.
It's really bad when you look at it on a giant 4K display.
I know, and it's all in you know, 1/4K or whatever, you know, whatever that was that they shot in 16mm, and you know, and it's terrible. Anyway, quick one, we're pretty much out of time. Is there anything we haven't asked you'd like us to have asked that you could answer quickly before we go?
Not really. No, I've been. So it's funny. Like I mentioned way earlier in my history and computing and stuff, I remember when Twit was a new thing, and Twit. It's funny. Like Twit has been. It's been like an undercurrent in the world of tech in different areas for so many years, and. I didn't realize how many different podcasts there are these days in kind of the Twitterverse. What is it called? The whole group, the collection of all the Twit podcasts.
I guess the
so it was cool to see, you know, how so many of these are still going on today and still popular and have really cool guests on them. And I'm honored to be on it finally after so many years ago when I was like, oh, that's a really cool whatever podcast that I would see on Twit. And now to be able to be on one, you know, it's a little point of pride for me.
So last two questions are control questions. What are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Text editor. So if I'm on the command line Nano, but typically Sublime Text, I've used that for about a decade now. And I like it because it's a good graphical interface for Mac, Windows, and Linux. And what was the other one?
Scripting language?
Language? Yeah. I go between Python and PHP. It depends on if I'm running it on like a Raspberry Pi or on a web server. So one of those two.
Cool. Well, it's been great having you on the show. We'll have to have you back at some point because I'm sure you'll be covering a lot more topics as time goes on. So thanks an awful lot for coming on the show. It's an honor to have you here
definitely.
Too.
Definitely. Thank you.
So Jonathan...
Yeah, that was fun.
That was good.
We could have we will have to have him back because things will continue to change, and we could have talked about a whole bunch of more things. I gotta convince him to try Flask next time he's on so that he can write Python code on his web servers too, because that's a lot of fun.
Maybe Raspberry Pis will come into the world again. You know, I did not even know that Raspberry Pis were getting scarce.
Oh no, it's been bad for like a year now. I mean, you can get them, but you got to pay about three times what they're worth. I mean, you got to pay $120 to get a Raspberry Pi off of eBay. It's bad. Getting a tiny bit better, but still that supply chain is in rough shape.
Where what's the what's the sphincter in that chain? Is it stuff from China or Russia or some other thing?
I'm not 100% sure. We'd have to bring somebody on from the Raspberry Pi Foundation to really give us the answer to that.
I know in a lot of cases
it's not your main chips. Like the Raspberry Pi is the SoC on it's a Broadcom. I know in a lot of cases it's not that Broadcom chip. It's the little tiny power regulator is what they can't get a hold of. And so I don't know if that's exactly what's going on with the Pis or not.
Interesting. I've got an old one. Maybe I should put it on eBay. Sitting in a closet in New York. I got it for my son, who decided that after Scratch, he wasn't interested in tech. So he likes Scratch, but it didn't go very far after that. So we're moving along here. So what do you got to plug before we get off?
Okay, so you can follow me over at Hackaday and Twitter. I'm still on Twitter. I also am on Mastodon, but I'm not jumping ship off of Twitter, at least not quite yet. JP_Bennett there. And then on the Discord, on the Club Twit Discord, we're doing an Ask Me Anything on the 17th. And that should be fun. I think it's with Ant. Just have a conversation about me and my history and things that people want to know. So looking forward to that, too.
Excellent. I should say I'm also on the back channel here telling a renter how to reset the modem in our house.
Tech support so, live.
All these things. I was doing live tech support there. Yeah. It's in a wiring closet downstairs. The right one. The left one's only got the switch that goes out. Anyway, so great having you on here, Jonathan. And
Good to be here.
We'll see the next one. And I have to plug next week. Next week, we have a very, very special guest. It's Greg Crowe Hartman, also known as Greg KH. Go to the Linux Kernel mailing list, the LKML, and you'll see that half the things going on there are his. An alpha maintainer of the Linux kernel for a long time. And he'll be calling in. That's going to be a really interesting show. And so that's coming up a week from now. I will be somewhere else, actually, than here, because I jump around. So until then, great seeing you guys. I'm Dr. Searles of Floss Weekly. We'll see you then.
Hey, folks, I'm Ant Pruitt. And what do you get your favorite tech geek that has everything? A Club Twit gift subscription, of course. Twit podcasts keep them informed and entertained with the most relevant tech news podcasts available. With the Club Twit subscription, they get access to all of our podcasts ad-free. They also get access to our members-only Discord, access to exclusive outtakes, behind-the-scenes, and special content such as AMAs, which I just love hosting, plus exclusive shows such as Hands on Mac, Hands on Windows, and the Untitled Linux Show. Purchase your Geek's Gift at twit.tv/clubtwit, and it will thank you every day.